thoughts on your magnificent university. There's a story about an admiral who got up every morning and he went to a safe. He opened the safe and he took out a single card and he read it and put it back into the safe and went about the business of running the ship. And people couldn't wait for him to get transferred because they just couldn't wait to see what was in that safe. And he did get transferred and they put out the card and what it said was, "Port is left, starboard is right." The story refers to something. In this Super Bowl season, you probably prefer something that Vincent Barry said. He said, if you can block and tackle, you can play with anybody. Well, we think that's your university. Lots and lots of exciting things, but nothing that isn't basic in terms of serving the needs of Alaska. Our success has come and will continue to come by getting everyone in the game. But it all starts here. The state is in the game. This is the seventh consecutive year that the governor has put into his budget the full Board of Regents request. This governor brought his entire cabinet up to Fairbanks to see how the research efforts there might aid and abet the state. He's going to bring it back in late spring. The legislature has funded us every year. Now it's maintenance level funding, but you've stuck with us. You gave me money when oil was $9 a barrel, and you started it here. It all starts here. The federal government is in the game. Between 01 and 04, federal grants went up 36% to now well over $100 million. And this is not an accident. My faculty averages across the system, and obviously not all of them are in the research business, but a simple math of the monies in divided by faculty, on the average, they raise $100,000 in federal grants. The national average is half of that. At Fairbanks, where our research is obviously more intensive, they average more than $200,000 per professor. Our students are in the game. We have half of our high school graduates now going to college. That's up from 44%. And half of those are coming to the university. That's up from 40%. Our retention of baccalaureate-seeking freshmen is up to 72% moving into their sophomore year. That's higher than the national average for open admission universities. Retention by Alaska scholars is in excess of 80%. Students are choosing the University of Alaska. We are up 35% in the high demand job programs that you directed us to highlight. Alaska Native first time freshman enrollment is up 53% over the last 5 years. And graduates are choosing Alaska. 86% of the Alaska scholars we have graduated to date, according to the Department of Labor, are at work in Alaska. And I've got 1,550 more in that pipeline coming to change this state. Our best are staying home, and that's the way it should be. There's nothing too good for the state of Alaska. Their attendance has meant a significant increase in tuition revenue. $48 million in the year 2000, $77 million today. And Alaskans, the citizens, are in the game. Between 01 and 04, private giving to the university is up 115%, and corporate giving up 35%. excluded from these figures are special projects like the museum, the KUAC promotions. This is just general giving. What that has meant to us is the UA Foundation, which had about $20 million in 1989, went to $40 million by 96, went to $80 million by the turn of the millennium, and today is $130 million, allowing them to distribute nearly $10 million to the university. Besides their money, Alaskan citizens serve on our advisory boards, programs, give scholarships, provide internships. Alaskans are in the game. And the university is in the game. We have to be. The 5% we've averaged in increased state funding is maintenance level. We have to generate more. In addition to tuition and the foundation funding, the significant funds from ConocoPhillips and BP compact agreements have allowed us to establish president's professors in key areas: fish and ocean science, bioinformatics, remote data processing, global climate change, global logistics, educational technology, Alaskan native language and culture, and coming very soon, president's professor in mining and engineering. We have partnerships with K-12 schools, Denali Commission Tech Center, trade unions, state virology lab. Fairbanks Borough has initiated a tax incentive program that's very, very promising. In Bethel and Norman and Fairbanks, we're working with communities and schools in the development of comprehensive job training centers. I remind people that collaboration doesn't mean talking together. That's convocation. Collaboration means laboring together. We've begun a program with DEED called Teacher Mentoring that addresses the needs of new teachers, especially in rural areas. This year, 350 new teachers have been assigned a mentor chosen by the districts. Their continuing education being taken care of by the university, and that program promises enormous success. In the military, you are enjoined to discover the center of gravity. It's that, on offense, it's that portion of an enemy's formation, the destruction of which will lead to the collapse of the whole. And on defense, it says, if you have something upon which everything depends, you better defend it. Now for Senators Dyson and Bundy, I'll do a bit more of a literary reference. If you were Achilles and you knew about your hero, you'd buy some armored Nikes. Well, we have such a heel. No one is against higher education. I love the university, but they're inefficient. It's been the cry across this country for decades. Before I ever saw this group, Senator Wilken gave me a counseling session, and what he said was, if you can be accountable, then things will change. And we have been accountable. We are out front in so many areas. The Board of Regents has directed that we spend $25 million on maintenance every year. Now, that's not enough to address the nearly $60 million worth of depreciation that is assessed against our facilities, but it's way out in front of any organization except for Alaska Housing and Finance. We're being accountable. We capped our university pension plan at $3,200. The state currently has a high cap of about 6,000. Now it's a different workforce, it's a different circumstance, this is only for comparison, but we're saving $3,000 per employee on our pension fund. We've developed a healthcare program called UA Choice, where individuals get to choose a healthcare program at lesser costs that will meet their specific needs. These are grown-ups, and they can make their own call. We established an optional retirement program, outside of pros and terms, doesn't require you to seek tenure. This works for us, or vestiture is what I mean. It works for us because we have a kind of transient workforce. What that means, and you have to wrestle with these pros and terms bills across the board, you're very familiar with it. What it means is we have provided a buyback program, $87 million of state avoidance of an unfunded liability. In other words, we've paid about a third of our PERS and TERS bogey that is the rest of the state. Now, you might note that in the governor's budget, we only funded for half of the PERS and TERS bill for this year. And frankly, I think in light of our initiatives and efforts to date, you can be sure I'll be seeking the other half. It doesn't seem to me that that's quite fair. We do program reviews, probably referred to by some pejorative term by the campuses, because twice a year, for about a day and a half, I sit down and simply go over the books. This is part one of the first of this year's two sessions just from UAA. We began a program called ACAS, Accountability and Sustainability. This was a program, find ways to save money. I think my first instinct on this was, let's form a bunch of committees, I'll give them some wonderful guidance, and we'll go out and we'll find the silver bullets. The only thing I did right was the committees were very inclusive. We had lots and lots of faculty and lots of staff to look over our accounts. What happened, as you might already presume, was we found no silver bullets. What we found was there were more than 100 golden BBs. $70,000 by stopping the sending out of a paper copy that told you we'd automatically put your paycheck in your bank. $70,000. $100,000 by consolidating the need for offset printing. $250,000 by not subsidizing dial-in to the internet, which we designed as a student-friendly program and found the students weren't using it. $60,000 by using the EasyBiz airline system. $60,000 worth of avoidance of tickets. We outsourced teleconferencing from a 20 cents per hour rate to 4 cents. We've reduced accounts receivable by 23%, and there's 100 more. My staff, as it turns out, can do anything. They're not just great workers, they care. 49% of my statewide staff contributed to the university last year. The national average is 17%. But believe me, they're only three times as good. Our front line is also our foundation. In 1862, before we were even a territory, the Morrill Land Grant Act, signed by President Lincoln, put forth a radical vision. He said, make higher education available to all. Well, we are an open admission university. He said, provide both liberal and practical education and training. Now, Morrill probably did not have in mind community colleges, but he clearly referred to what we know and support as workforce training. The Morrill Act dealt primarily with rural Alaska, primarily with agriculture. 60% of America was agricultural in 1862. Today it's about 2%, and universities have wandered off into different focuses. But we have embraced a broader agenda addressing economic, social, and environmental issues in our rural areas. In Ketchikan, the Marine Technology Program. In Kenai, working with local community and mining community to make preparations for the job training needs and the expansion that the industry will demand. We've already had one internal meeting and have organized a comprehensive mining summit in March. There are similar programs of collaboration in every community campus in our system. Morrell says, over time, develop a research agenda. And we have developed an agenda that is closely tied to our geographical location and deals with Alaskan issues. Everything from micro-miniaturization to horticulture products, infrastructure, working with DOT on roads and embankments, working with BLM and DNR on tundra ponds and pumping for ice roads, health and bioscience, hibernation, biotechnology, infectious disease, behavioral health. We have the state seismologist. We have the state climatologist. We have the Earthquake Information Center, Alaska Volcano Observatory, and Tsunami Protection, and so forth. Research in snow and ice, permafrost, coastal erosion, Alaskan Ocean Observing System. Understanding leads to management. And Morrell continued, institutions should extend themselves beyond the labs and classrooms and be engaged in outreach and partnerships with the citizens and the state they serve. Now, I've already listed a small portion of our outreach and partnerships, but it goes on, cooperative extension program, working with the Youth Center in Bethel, Marine Advisory Program, COTS Tech Center, Small Business Development Center, Hutchison Career Center, Business Enterprise Institute. All in all, they constitute 80 offices in more than 50 cities and villages in the state. I believe the University of Alaska is closer to the original intent of the Morrell Act than any land-grant college in this country. Now, we have challenges. None of them are new. Healthcare costs rising at a minimum of 15%, facilities cost, predicted tightness in federal dollars. We have an issue in enrollment of part-time students. Our student body is changing to more and more and more of kind of classic first-time freshmen, people coming in for full-time experiences. It's small, but we're seeing a drop-off in the number of individuals who are taking one course or two. And we're looking into that. There's a number of factors. You can think of many of them, I'm sure. It deals with economy. It deals with affordability. We even think higher gas prices has stopped some of our commuting students to our rural campuses. But we're looking into that. It's a challenge. And if you really open admission multi-purpose, you better be able to take care of the part-time student. Well, we're asking for another maintenance level budget, but I want you to consider more. I want you to consider an investment in research. Research is an industry all by itself. Research eventually will create other industries. As a state, we invest about 1% of our gross state product. The national average is about 2.7%. For Alaska to reach national levels, we'd have to increase our investment by almost $500 million. That's ridiculous. But I have a plan for you. I want you to fund phase one of a five-year plan. Not $500 million, not $100 million. I want you to look at investing $20 million over the next 5 years. What, $2.5 million this year? I believe we can maintain our leverage, currently 7-1, at about 6-1 over that period of time. If we can do our share of collaboration, the university can expect to move your investment to $140 million over 5 years, and that cuts our gap against the nation by almost a third. I have other requests I want you to consider. Funding a portion of the Alaska Scholars Program. Its success has outstripped the primary source of funds, which is our natural resource fund. Remember that 86% of our graduates to date are currently at work in the state, and there are 1,550 more coming. Stop the brain drain. That's what you told me to do, and it's happening. We are doing everything I believe is possible at the university to reallocate funds, form partnerships, to get external grants, but it's time to move to a new level. And like everything else, it begins here. Your leadership is central. You represent all of Alaska. The university is not just waiting for your funding. We are waiting for your charge. And we're prepared to take us all forward. For this great state and its future, I believe there are no silver bullets. I don't think the gas pipeline is a silver bullet. I don't think Anwar is a silver bullet. It's going to be engaged Alaskans as the thousands of golden boobies that'll save the day. At the university, we are part of you, we admire you, and we will serve you. But it all starts here. Madam Chairman, I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, President Hamilton. I'm sure there are questions. Anyone like to, Senator Bundy?
Thank you. Thank you, President Hamilton. There are times when we haven't always agreed, but I think we do agree on one thing, that the university is one of the important state functions. We might disagree on where the priority is in that one, but we agree that it is certainly one of them. And so none of my questions should be taken as criticism. I appreciate the energy and the work you've brought to your job, and I'm just seeking more information.
I understand.
You mentioned land grant several times, and one of the things that some of us here in the legislature have been hopeful that the university could move on toward more traditional land grant, where that your lands that you've been granted are providing income. And could you update us on how that's going and how we might continue to help?
There have been continuing efforts, I think you're aware, that to try to transfer some lands from the university. The larger issue involved that Senator Murkowski, the former Senator Murkowski, was very, very keen on, which was giving land grant to the university, which for those of you who may not know, currently has a land grant that is smaller than the state. The land grant is smaller than the land grant given to the state of Rhode Island. On the most unconscionable of land grant issue. But we have legislation that I think will be put forth this year to try again to transfer to the university some lands. I always have two thoughts on lands. One is the people who are trying to get to your friends. Once you get them, it's, well, we gave you land, what do you need now? You know, the last time we went through this drill, just to give you perspective, this is good. You want the land, without a doubt. But solving problems, let me just give you a feel for this. The last land grant bill that came through here, that was subsequently vetoed, et cetera. Our best guess is that having been transferred those lands with the very best work we can possibly do with a fabulous land management team, was earned an endowment at the end of 20 years that would have provided an annuity of about $5 million to the university. Now that's not bad, that would fund Alaska scholars, and you want to have that, but I'm sure we'll be fighting for 20 years telling you why the land won't solve it. So we need it. It is just, it's not the kind of a project that is going to meet the immediate needs of the university.
Go ahead.
I share your frustration there. More of a traditional university people would support a land grant. Maybe we can move forward. Another source of funding, of course, particularly for capital endeavors for the university, is the earnings reserve of the Herman Fund. And if we could have more support from the university community, perhaps that funding source would become available not only for the university, for other essential services. I just ask that as a plea. Question for information. I see the retention rate of freshmen on your charter, and you know, we both know that
colleges are probably one of the same times you have to
make a couple of tries at it before you either find out it is or isn't for you. What's the attempt rate among high school graduates, Alaska high school graduates? I understand it's higher than the national average, but 30-40% of high school graduates end up at the university.
Well, we have 50% are going to college, we get 50% of those. So 25% of everybody who graduates from high school in a single year comes to the university.
And at the end of 4 or 5 years, more realistically, about half of those graduate, then is that?
I don't believe that half do graduate.
No, not even as many.
72% make it to their sophomore year. That is not just attempts. That is people who have come to seek a baccalaureate degree. When you embrace the community college mission, you have to understand there's a whole lot of people there who don't want that degree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or eventually discover, as you point out, that they don't want that degree, and they end up taking a shorter course, a certificate course, an associate course, or the like, and decide to move on. Extremely difficult to find out which of these people would have been a community college student when they came here. But for open admission universities, they all suffer about the same thing, and we're really very, very pleased that our retention rate has moved up so very high.
And I would, thank you, Madam Chair. One more issue. On this one, I think on the bright side, there are those who start in the certificate and choose to stay longer. So, the point I was getting to, and we all share the concern about funding. And I know other schools have found people who become professional students. And so they've suggested if you don't actually graduate after 5 years, then your tuition goes up. If you plan to change your major in your senior year, or if you plan to dabble at going to school, because the state is paying, about 60-70% of the actual cost tuition?
Certainly 60.
Yeah, the actual cost, the actual tuition pays only about 30% of the actual cost.
That's correct.
And so I'm asking that you consider what other schools have done to encourage people to graduate sooner. I mean, we all know the problems with students with $40,000, $50,000 in debt when they graduate, and the longer they dabble, the higher the debt, and the higher the cost of the state.
I look forward to talking to you about that, Senator.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is in Hamilton. Always nice to have you back for seventh year. Particularly nice to see that you brought along your able assistant, Wendy Redmond. It's nice to see Wendy, and I hope that you're working her as hard as you worked her when she was here working for you. I was looking around the table, and I think five of us have the benefit of hearing the report of the university for a couple of years. And that would be defined as the university before your arrival. So I think today I take great pride and accept your challenges to continue what your initiatives that you told us 7 years ago you were going to do. And you've come back and done many of the things that the people of Alaska and this legislature have asked you to do. And we say thank you to you and to your many employees that are working so hard for us. A couple of questions, if I may. Madam Chair, could you circle around a little bit and go back to your mentoring program and touch a little bit more on that? You know, it's been a problem in our K-12 community to get more teachers from Alaska, and I think the number is 30, and you want to drive that number upwards. And this is a part of that. So
yes.
Talk a little bit more about that mentoring program, if you would.
It's interesting to read about the challenges of teachers, but if you listen to what teachers say, it's really quite interesting. They say pay is not a four.
teachers who leave the profession say, what I didn't have was a comfort in the classroom, support by my bosses, support by my community. The mentoring process is this.
So, 350 new teachers
have had the benefit of a mentor, somebody who has been there, done that, was excellent at it, provides them support, provides them the kind of on-the-job vocational skills that, that seek that comfort level. And now we're going to track this for a very long time, but if you get a teacher who is comfortable more quickly and stays longer, you simply must predict that we're going to raise student achievement. It just makes sense. We're also going to save money for people floating back and forth. Well, we're only one semester through, but let me just offer one little data point. Of those 350 teachers, none of them quit at Christmas. Now, the first time I was told that, I said, you mean people quit at Christmas? 15 to 25 teachers every year quit at Christmas. 200 of these teachers are in rural Alaska. We believe that this program, in cooperation with DEED, we really believe that this program is going to change that turnover thing that costs us money, hurts our students. And I think it's off to a wonderful start. Very excited about it.
I remember back 10 or 12 years ago before I took this temporary part-time job. And the stories I hear, because my wife worked up in the chancellor's office at UAF, the horror stories she would hear about the challenges of the students just doing things, simply checking their records or registering, the manual process that happens through horrible lines. I know because I've talked to folks, students, and I've talked to folks that are involved in the process. Will you talk about your online class management, registration, that whole system of online interface between the university perspective and current students?
Yeah, it is a remarkable thing to watch, because I'm certainly not one of that generation that has grown up with the web and everything. This is a type, we couldn't change it fast enough. And the students themselves critiqued it, and we went through a process of putting it together, because they know this wasn't user-friendly change. This had all kinds of meetings, primarily with students. But the overwhelming majority of our students now apply online. We followed that up with a financial aid application. And just to give you an idea, we had more people apply online last year than previously had applied by any form 2 years prior. Now, this is good because we have been concerned for a number of years at the university that our students don't apply for aid and grants at the same rate that we see them happening in the lower 48. And we feel like it's got to be a matter of exposure. These things are out there. Now it's on the web, and they're on. You can do every function you still need to do, except for the direct career-level counseling online.
Representative Stoltz, oh, before we do that, I did want to recognize that Senator Hoffman is here and Representative Guttenberg. Welcome. Go ahead, Representative Stoltz.
Chairman Green, Mr. Hamilton. I want to thank you. Back in early 2004, I wanted to get my Chamber of Commerce involved in the selection of the Chancellor for Anchorage, and they jumped at the chance, and I appreciate it. And followed up, we had a nice reception out in Eagle River, and the Chamber really felt engaged, so thanks for your receptivity to that, and it was a real success. The question I have is, we had a special election back in 1999, and ICER was very involved in supplying objective information. And we had the head of ICER appearing in advertisements, print, and electronic media. I can't remember his name, Mr. Goldschmidt, I can't.
Scott Goldschmidt.
Yeah, whether there's the, some might question the propriety of it, of having a, an academic research agency being involved in a political campaign, and maybe even the pragmatism, given that it that, was a resounding flop. I mean, have you learned any lessons and maybe about backing ICER off of political endeavors in the future?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific thing you're talking about, but there are specific prohibitions against getting involved in political campaigns. Now, if somebody is the source of researched information and a particular party or candidate wants to quote that information, it seems to me that that's it's part of the public domain when ICER finds a product. I can't address a specific issue, but we have specific prohibitions, so we don't support the endorsement of a candidate or appearing in an ad for a candidate. Yeah. So I'd like to hear more about that.
Chairman, I have vivid memories, and I'm sure other folks do, but that's just the other question I have, and it's more of a philosophical. There's University of Denver is going through quite a controversy. If Ward Churchill was working for UAA today and he had made that the speech that he made in the comments, how would you as a president handle that, and how would our citizens reflect their dissatisfaction with the university, and what I guess in a nutshell, how would our folks that would probably be up in arms be able to affect their opinions through any practical means?
Well, I think what happens very often is that individuals are not aware of the unintended association of who they are with the place they work for. You know, when somebody comes on, they will be identified, perhaps, somebody wants to make a statement in the paper, they'll be identified as the president of the university or a professor over here. You probably not going to have somebody identify as currently working for this particular private fund. We encourage people to try to make the distinction between their personal opinion and reflecting any values or any positions taken by the institution. In terms of what they say, if I have professors or people who work for me who have an opinion that is outlandish, ridiculous, or stupid, I simply fall back to the Constitution of the United States and say, you know, I kind of wish they hadn't because it's kind of embarrassed me, but by golly, I spent 31 years of my life defending their right to do it and not going to back off now.
Senator Dyson.
Marvelous presentation. I was surprised when you talked about kind of the what came from the kind of exit interviews with the folks that left, the teachers. I know in the K-12 population, most folks say two things that really bothered them. One is inability to control the classroom, which I expect is much less of a problem in the university. You know, and behavior there is probably better. But the second one is they dreamed of being a teacher so they could make a difference in individual students' lives. And what has driven them away from the profession is the various factors that keep them from being able to really make a difference in a homo sapiens life. And that wasn't in your list of four things. Comment on that, sir?
You know, I would have to take a guess, Senator, and what I would say is they probably have ascribed their failure to do that with the lack of support piece. You know, the lack of support. I have to do all these other things instead of, and that sort of thing. So I suspect it is an important issue in their minds, but it's probably subsumed under those very general characteristics that I gave you there. Yeah, but that's probably right.
Probably insightful and probably something that all of you in management ought to look at. Are there things that are keeping teachers from interacting with the students and affecting their lives because they're off? You know,
going to faculty meetings or filling out paperwork or looking for a parking place.
Well, exactly. And let me just throw, I really could have talked for a long, long time on this teacher mentorship road, because there's another piece of this. After our teacher mentors are out there with our new teachers for 2 or 3 years, we need to bring them back to the university and outline these things. Look, here is what is missing. Here are the major problems. They bring it back to the university so we can teach it better. They bring it back to DEED so we can start to put some management on the critical issues. So I think many of those things will pop out as they give the feedback report. And now we've got a system, you know. We don't just throw a doctor out there, we give them a residency. And then the university seeks the input from the master's teaching residency. What do we need to do differently? What are the techniques, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of a flow where I would certainly hope that in the future some of these mentor teachers will become instructors. Initially, I think we'll go to the point where we have one or two as assigned advisors to the departments of education around the state. Begin to share this thing, and then we've got a program that can resolve some of these issues that have been around for decades.
Last question. I'm kind of intrigued about what should diversity mean in a faculty? Not the student body, but in the faculty, what, if anything, should we shoot for or aim at in terms of diversity in the faculty?
Well, there's I'm sure you're referring, there's a very significant national debate on at this time that it's quite clear that the majority of faculty members across the United States, by their report, are very aligned with a single segment of the politics of the country. I think, frankly, the profession is able to deal with that by the reminder, and this debate will be a reminder, that the classroom has to be open to all opinions. It has to be a place where not political correctness, not party affiliation, or religious affiliation is used as a sort of bully pulpit. And the profession is founded on that. And if they have momentarily forgotten that, the fact that it is a public issue now will go a very long way toward self-correction, because they believe it. They believe that the university ought to be a place where all opinions can be expressed, and I frankly have enough trust in the profession that they will adjust themselves, having been sort of thusly accused of having forgotten it.
I might follow up. Your assumptions of what my question was about are kind of went beyond.
But, oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. You're often always insightful. As we try to attract and keep students, particularly from rural Alaska, and hopefully get more in the faculty, it's got to make those kids feel more comfortable when they come to a very different culture and so on, to have some people who have lived and worked in rural Alaska and so on. I probably neither of us really are interested in a quota system, but you know, very, very helpful in some offline. You can talk to me about how many Alaskan Aboriginal people are represented in the faculty and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But just the idea that a particular philosophical position won't be ridiculed or bullied in the classroom finally doesn't go far enough, it seems to me. You know, should we have a diversity of philosophical positions being presented by the faculty?
It would be ideal. I think that faculties, like businesses and like a lot of other things, run the risk of choosing associates or choosing successors who are a lot like you. I think we all have that threat. Because the principle of the profession supports it, I think there's a much greater chance of having diversity within a faculty and within a department than there probably is in having those kinds of diversities exist within private business.
Thank you. Representative Rywalk.
I just wanted to appreciate Senator Bundy's comments. It made me feel like my father giving me the Dutch uncle talk about getting out of school. appreciated we didn't hear the phrase economic engine by the university from you, President.
Did I forget that?
The questions had to do with two things. One is when the regions come out with a priority list, it seems like the priorities can move. Priority 1 month or one before one meeting changes at the next meeting, so I'm not sure how the prioritization moves up and down with respect to its direction to the university. And second, whether there's a standard that the university has with respect to the ratio between administrative positions and faculty positions, because a lot of comments I get have to do with the number of provosts, vice provosts, chancellors, vice chancellors, directors, associate directors, and that sort of thing at the university in relation to the faculty. I just wondered about those.
Well, when you have an institution that's got to handle everything from GED to PhD and is spread over 14 campuses, you're going to have a different kind of ratio in administrators than you would if they were all sitting around one great institution. So that need to be located in many, many places in order to serve the state of Alaska does hurt that ratio for us, although it compares quite well with the national average, as does our staffing, another thing that you hear about all the time. Let me just address that staffing just a moment. Because I do get that question quite a bit, why do you have so many staff? Our staff to student and our staff to faculty ratios are very similar to the national average, which tells you absolutely that we are understaffed. Let me tell you something that everybody ought to understand about this great institution. By embracing the entire spectrum, the University of Alaska, the single biggest difference between the University of Alaska and any of its peer institutions is the number of part-time students. This is a huge efficiency challenge. If you have four students taking 3 credit hours versus one student taking 12, you've got to register them 4 times, counsel them 4 times, do the paperwork on finances 4 times, et cetera, et cetera. Much, much more difficult. When you have a small state directly connected by road systems, it's quite easy to point out to people another opportunity to take a course or to pursue their education. What that part-time statistic tells you is our students work. I mean, this isn't just a little part-time job. Many, many, many of our students work 40 hours a week. So you have to maintain offerings in several different places because they're essentially place-bound by their job. So those things affect it. But believe me, those things are constant issues with us, constant assessments, because they are areas that we are very often asked questions.
Representative Rywalk, you need to sit up to the mic so they can...
Priority list question.
The Board of Regents puts forth a series of principles upon which to rate all capital projects. And they deal with a number of things. They deal with how much external funding are we going to get for this thing, how many students will be served by this thing, how quickly can it be designed, or is it in the design process, or this sort of thing. And the list comes out. And once that list is laid out, then the Board of Regents comes back, and sometimes they think their priorities didn't quite develop what they had hoped to do for other, frankly, opportunistic reasons. Here we have a case where this is going to be partially funded by the federal government. Maybe it's best to move that up and seek that funding now. It would be an example of that. And so that's why the list will change from time to time as you get other opportunities to move forward.
We have about 2 minutes before we're going to wrap up here. And does anyone have a question before Senator Bundy asks the final question? Or your...
Thank you. And it relates to the open university, open admissions policy. And I realize that complicates your job, but to your great credit, I think you've embraced that. And I hope that the University of Alaska never changes that, even though it complicates it, makes things more expensive. With that in mind, a two-pronged question. Anecdotally, we hear a lot about the liberal arts graduate who's got a job clerking somewhere with a $30,000 college debt. To alleviate that, I heard that the university is working back toward the community college program, and I'd like to know if that is still a focus. And another concern you and I have shared is the high level of remediation that the university, the school, has had to provide for our high school graduates. And if you could just address those two issues briefly, I'd appreciate it.
Let me take the second one first. Not another story, because you've all heard about the for want of a nail. I will tell you that the for want of a nail that we discovered isn't directly a university issue. We certainly do this in areas where nobody else can do it, like in Bethel and all that. But adult basic education is a fundamental need for people in jobs. And I've made this statement, and I absolutely believe it with the data I have presented. If we could provide sufficient adult basic education in the state of Alaska, we would have more Alaskans filling more jobs than will be created by the simultaneous opening of Anwar and building of a gas pipeline. More Alaskans and more jobs than if either one of those things happened. Remediation goes even beyond the university. There's a whole adult basic education piece that can bring them up to where we can kind of reach down and pick them up. So it's a problem that's much larger than the university that is going to be needed if we're going to put Alaskans into jobs. One of the things that is helping us move back to the community college mindset really reflects from when we were given a charge. You know, we used to have this whole missions and measures. We don't have to report those anymore. There was some, well, we kept them.
This is valuable. This is what people said they wanted us to go. Let's look at it.
35% increase in these high demand jobs. People come in and say, there's a job out there. They're inspired by that. We see them sign up for those jobs and go forward. So understanding that there's some people in this toward a vocational end has really helped to build this awareness of the need to provide a community college education.
So I want to comment that Senator Seekins was in the room and then left, and then we've been joined by Senator Joy Huggins. Welcome. I know that if any of you or any of us have questions, further questions, or need other follow-up information, that President Hamilton or his staff will be happy to supply that for us. And I'm sure you're in the building for a while, and so if you want to catch him after the meeting, I'm sure you can get another question answered. I have no announcement at this time of the next finance meeting. We'll have to watch the board this afternoon for the schedule for next week. We want to thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know that everyone appreciates the information. And with that, Senate Finance and the combined House Finance meeting with the university is adjourned.